Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Damien Carrick and this is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. I'm from the Law Report program here on ABC Radio National, where we often touch upon the big issues surrounding human rights and the legal processes we have to protect them. One lawyer very much at the centre of these sorts of debates is Julian Burnside QC. Over the years, his running battle with John Howard's government was played out in our newspapers and broadcast media. From children in detention to security legislation, Burnside has been an untiring critic of what he sees as attacks on the rule of law. We've heard him many times on Radio National argue the case for asylum seekers, David Hicks, and recently Dr. Haneef. Today, a chance to hear him in long form, courtesy of this year's Manning Clark Lecture. Julian Burnside was chosen as the ninth Manning Clark Lecturer, an oration delivered each year in Canberra around Manning Clark's birthday in early March. Past lecturers have included Frank Brennan, Barry Jones, and Paul Keating. As you can see, the organisers want the lecture to pack some punch, and this year's is certainly a strong jab to the midsection. As you can guess, post-federal election, Julian Burnside has a lot to get off his chest. While applauding Kevin Rudd's apology to the Stolen Generation, he maintains there is still unfinished business. He argues the question of compensation remains open. Burnside is also well known for his opposition to our migration and anti-terror laws. Here, he builds a case against ministerial discretion, arguing his preference for the rule of law rather than the rule of men. Here is Julian Burnside in front of a large turnout at the National Library of Australia with the 2008 Manning Clark Lecture.
Thank you very much. Now, in his epilogue to his History of Australia, Manning Clark wrote this: "This generation has a chance to be wiser than previous generations. They can make their own history. With the end of the domination by the straighteners, the enlargers of life now have their chance. It is the task of the historian and the mythmaker to tell the story of how the world came to be as it is. It is the task of the prophet to tell the story of what might be. The historian presents the choice. History is a book of wisdom for those making the choice." Now, leave aside the fact that self-evidently he was perhaps premature in noting the end of the domination by the straighteners, because they seem to be making something of a resurgence here and in America. The fact is that on the 24th of November 2007, Australia made a choice. History presented us with a choice, and to the surprise of some and the delight of, I was going to say many, but perhaps a narrow majority is more accurate, Australia chose the ALP and brought to an ignominious end the rule of the Howard government. Now, historians hereafter will probably have varying opinions about what explained that choice, which was made in November of last year. From this close distance, it seems likely that the reason John Howard was drummed out of government and out of parliament was for exactly the same reason that Stanley Milburn Bruce suffered the same fate three generations earlier. Australians, by and large, just didn't like his approach to industrial relations. And that's a good enough reason, I guess. I would have preferred to see the government tossed out for its wretched record in relation to human rights, its mistreatment of asylum seekers, and its depredations on the rule of law, but perhaps Australia is not yet sufficiently mature to approach an election that way. In any event, the electorate, I think, saw industrial relations as somewhat more pressing. But whatever the reason, we made a choice. And the magnitude of the choice we made last November became evident recently in the most remarkable way. In the first sitting of the new parliament, the government said sorry to the Stolen Generations. It seemed almost too good to be true. And the words, which I understand were written by Rudd, were some of the noblest and most dignified words ever uttered in that place on the hill. It was astonishing and uplifting to hear at last the dreadful recent history of our country acknowledged, frankly, for what it was. And it's worth, I think, recalling some of the words because it introduces the first major subject I want to discuss. Today we honour the Indigenous peoples of this land, the oldest continuing cultures in human history. We reflect on their past mistreatment. We reflect in particular on the mistreatment of those who were stolen generations, this blemished chapter in our nation's history. We apologise for the laws and policies of successive parliaments and governments that have inflicted profound grief, suffering and loss on these our fellow Australians, for the pain, suffering and hurt of these stolen generations, their descendants and for their families left behind. We say sorry. To the mothers and the fathers, the brothers and the sisters, for the breaking up of families and communities, we say sorry. And for the indignity and degradation thus inflicted on a proud people and a proud culture, we say sorry. We today take this first step by acknowledging the past and laying claim to a future that embraces all Australians, a future where this Parliament resolves that the injustices of the past must never, never happen again. Now, the 13th of February 2008 will be remembered, I think, as a day when the nation shifted perceptibly. The apology was significant not only because it marks a significant step in the process of reconciling ourselves with a dark chapter in our history, but it cast new light on the Howard government so recently removed. And I think it reminded us of something which we had lost, a sense of decency. Most of the worst aspects of the 11 and a half years of John Howard's rule can be explained by the lack of decency which infected their approach to government. They couldn't acknowledge the wrong that had been done to the stolen generations. No one was suggesting they had done it, but they just couldn't acknowledge that what happened was wrong. They failed to help David Hicks when helping him was a moral imperative, and only came to his aid, finally, lately, when it became a political imperative. They never quite understood the wickedness of imprisoning innocent children in detention centres. They attacked the court scandalously but unblushing in a way which I think we've never seen before in this country. They argued in the courts for the right to detain innocent people for life. They introduced laws which prevent fair trials. They introduced laws which allow people to be jailed without any trial at all and without access to the evidence. And they bribed the impoverished Republic of Nauru to warehouse asylum seekers for us to avoid us having the inconvenience of looking after them in the tiny numbers in which they were arriving. It was as if they just didn't understand how badly they were behaving, and as if we, the community, were not prepared to point it out to them, perhaps because we were too embarrassed to acknowledge it, or perhaps we were just deflected from the indecency of their style of government because we're all doing pretty well in our own lives. And they're not able to change their ways in defeat. Just, look at the last few weeks. You've seen prominent backbenchers all scrambling for the lifeboats. Last week, Mark Vaile was off in Japan, rorting his parliamentary salary and paving the way for a new cosy endeavour that he's preparing for himself. And John Howard defied political convention by delivering himself of an unrepentant speech to the American neocons as they limped through the final agonising months of the most embarrassing president since Ulysses S. Grant. One of the most compelling things about the apology to the stolen generations was that it was so decent. Suddenly, a dreadful episode in our history was acknowledged, and it was as if we could now decently turn to a new future. Unfortunately, when announcing that the government would apologise to the stolen generations, Mr Rudd also said that the government had no intention of setting up a scheme to compensate people who suffered as a consequence of the policies of earlier times. I think that was unfortunate, and I would like to explain why. First, let us look briefly at the realities of the stolen generations and the attempts of some of their members to win recognition for what they suffered and what was suffered by many others of them in their attempts to get compensation for what was done to them. There have been three attempts in litigation to recover damages for members of the Stolen Generations, one in the Northern Territory, one in New South Wales, and one in South Australia. Now, the South Australian case is the most recent. The plaintiff was a bloke called Bruce Trevorrow. He was the illegitimate son of Joe Trevorrow and Thora Lampard. They lived at One Mile Camp Meningi. Meningi is down on the Coorong in South Australia. Even now, it's a one-horse town. Back in the 1950s, when Bruce was born, it must have been a very modest place indeed. But Joe and Thora didn't live in Meningi because it was illegal in those days for Aborigines to live closer than 1 mile to a place of white settlement unless they had a permit. And so they lived at One Mile Camp in a hut made out of flattened out oil drums and old bits of sackcloth. When Bruce was 13 months old, he got gastroenteritis. Joe didn't have a car which would take him up to the hospital, and so a neighbour from Meningi took him there. And the hospital records show that Bruce was admitted to the Adelaide Children's Hospital on Christmas Day 1957, aged 13 months. He was given appropriate treatment, and about a week later his gastro was cured. A week after that, he was given away to a white family. The white family lived in suburban Adelaide. They had a daughter who at the time was 16 or 17 years old, and she came to the trial and gave evidence as a woman in her late middle age. And she said she remembered this day very clearly because her mother had always wanted a second daughter. And they saw an advertisement in the paper offering Aboriginal babies for fostering. So they went along. Their Sunday outing on this occasion was to go and get an Aboriginal baby. They went to the hospital and they saw a lineup of Aboriginal babies, and they saw a very cute curly-headed little girl and said, "We'll have that one," and took her home. That was all the formality that was needed. When they got her home and changed her nappy, they discovered she was a boy. And Bruce remained with them thereafter until a little over his 10th birthday. A little while after Bruce had been given away to the Davies family, his mother wrote to the department. She wrote asking how he was doing and when he was coming home. Now, it may seem a small thing for a mother in those circumstances to write to the department, but it's easy to forget that at One Mile Camp Meningi, an envelope and a sheet of writing paper and a pen and a stamp were not articles readily obtained. But she got together what she needed and she wrote to them, and in due time she got an answer. And the answer and the original letter still on the files of the Aborigines Department. The answer said, "Bruce is doing quite well, but the doctors say he's not well enough to come home yet." They had already given him away. The other document which remained on their files then and to this day was a written opinion by the Crown Solicitor, dated 2 years before Bruce was born, telling them that as a matter of law, they had no legal power to take Aboriginal children from their parents. The minutes of the department filled with complaints about the inconvenience of not having the legal power to take Aboriginal babies from their parents. And in fact, they also include some interesting letters in which, for example, the head of the Aborigines Department, a secretary of the department, wrote this. This was written in 1958, the year that Bruce was given away. This is written to his counterpart in Victoria. "Again, in confidence, for some years, without legal authority, the board have taken charge of many Aboriginal children. Some are placed in Aboriginal institutions, which, by the way, I very much dislike, and others are placed with foster parents, all at the cost of the board. At the present time, I think there are approximately 300 children so placed." The records of the department acknowledge that they knew they were acting unlawfully, and yet what they were doing was giving effect to a policy of assimilation, which said, broadly speaking, male Aborigines, who are of 100% Aboriginal blood, will die out. They should be left to themselves. Part Aborigines, whether half-caste or quadroons or octoroons, as they were called, and especially those who are paler in complexion, will do better if we place them in white society, and we do that by removing them from their families when the occasion offers itself. Now, going back to Bruce's story, plainly enough from that letter you'll see that there was nothing exceptional about the fact that he was taken because the opportunity had presented itself. But later on, the law at the time, I should say at the time, the law required that foster parents should be licensed and fostering arrangements should be supervised by regular inspection 4 times a year. Mrs. Davies did not have a foster mother's licence. That was obtained for her after the event by the Aborigines Department and was backdated. The licensing authority never spoke to or questioned Mrs. Davies at all. Neither was the fostering arrangement ever supervised, although the law required 4 times a year the child and the house should be inspected. The department never again paid any attention to what was happening to Bruce. But he did come to notice of the authorities when he was 3 because he was admitted to the Children's Hospital aged 3, tearing his own hair out. Anyone with a child will notice that immediately as a sign of distress. He was brought to the attention of the Child Guidance Clinic when he was aged 9, because at age 9 he was still soiling himself. He was beginning to get in trouble of a minor sort. He was becoming quite difficult. They diagnosed him as profoundly depressed and anxious and noted that he appeared to have no sense of his own identity. That might be explained by the fact that his foster mother had always brought him up, explicitly telling him that he was her natural child. She explained his slightly darker complexion by reference to the fact that she came from Wales, and in Wales she had some relatives who were darker complexioned. When his behaviour became difficult, she told him that, in fact, he was not hers. She was an Aborigine, he was an Aborigine, and if he didn't behave better, she'd send him back. She was told several times by the Child Guidance Clinic that this was likely to be very painful to him and likely to damage him, but she persisted with doing it. When Bruce was 10, the law had changed, and the department, who had so far prevented Thora, his mother, from finding out where he was, were forced by law to let her know where he was. And so on Bruce's 10th birthday, he met his natural mother for the first time. His father, unfortunately, had died 6 months earlier, so he never met him. But he met his mother on his 10th birthday, and this was sort of interesting to him. And so it was arranged that he would have a holiday with them in a few months' time. The time duly arrived, and the welfare people came to his house in suburban Adelaide and put him on the bus to send him down to Victor Harbour. And after the bus had gone, the foster mother said, "He's too much trouble, I won't have him back." And so they posted his clothes and his toys after him. That was the way he was reunited with his family, even though the welfare department knew that a reunion of that sort had to be handled with the greatest care. The fact is, absolutely nothing was done to prepare either him or them for a reunion which was bound to be pretty trying for both. Now, Bruce's trial had some pretty striking features. One of them was the extraordinary difference between Bruce as a person, as a witness, on the one hand, and his brothers, Tom and George, who had not been taken as children, who'd grown up on the Coorong with Joe and Thora, who told stories of Joe teaching them Aboriginal stories, teaching them about the Coorong, teaching them how to track animals, how to catch emus, how to catch kangaroos, how to fish, and all this and that. They presented as strong, resilient, resourceful people. Bruce presented as a man utterly broken by life. Interestingly, Bruce, who shuffled along and gave all of his evidence looking at his feet, except at one point, when I asked him towards the end of his evidence in chief where he belonged, and he teared up and paused for about half a minute and eventually said, "Nowhere." Tom and George, it looked, might be too late to come to the trial and give evidence because they had just arrived back from overseas where they had been attending a meeting of international Indigenous leaders on the repatriation of Indigenous remains. The difference between the three men could not have been more striking. The second striking feature of the case was that the state of South Australia, which in many respects has a great deal to commend it, fought every single point in the case. Everything was contested. They argued, for example, that the Crown Solicitor's opinion was wrong. Well, they're entitled to argue that because it is, after all, just a matter of interpreting the statute. But they said even if it's correct, it doesn't apply because we didn't take him from his parents. We took him from the hospital. They argued that it did not harm a child to be taken from his or her parents. And they pressed that point with great vigour, which led to one of the most useful and interesting findings in the case, because as it was a real question of contest, whether it was harmful to a child to be removed from their parents, we called a great deal of psychiatric evidence, including a survey of the psychiatric literature during the 1950s, the relevant time, in order to demonstrate that not only was it the state of scientific knowledge then that it was harmful to remove children from their parents, but in addition, that the state either did or should know the fact at the time. The state attempted to keep that evidence out, but failed. The judge found in his judgment, and I quote from paragraph 885, "I find that it was reasonably foreseeable," and this is in 1957, "that the separation of a 13-month-old Aboriginal child from his natural mother and family and the placement of that child in a non-Indigenous family for long-term fostering created real risks to the child's health. The state, through its emanations, departments and officers, either foresaw those risks or ought to have foreseen those risks." It's a very important and powerful finding because it's based on evidence which is quite unrelated to Bruce's individual circumstances, because what it amounts to is a finding about the state of scientific knowledge in Australia in the 1950s, based substantially on the work of John Bowlby, whose most famous work on parental separation was published by the United Nations in, I think, 1951, and then in Penguin paperback in 1952. Bowlby's work was seminal. It also, I should say, accords with common sense. Human instinct tells you that if you take a child from his or her parents, both the child and the parents will suffer. But what was interesting was the state also objected to the introduction of another document in evidence. The point in question was, does it harm a child to be taken from the parents? The document gave a history of the removal of Aboriginal children in the state of South Australia during the 1950s and 60s. It identified the numbers who'd been taken, and it said that the children had suffered terrible harm as a result, as had the parents. It then listed the characteristic harm suffered by children taken from their parents. And the list of characteristic harm matched exactly the diagnoses that Bruce had been receiving from the age of 9 years old until the day of the trial when he was 49 years old. It was like a checklist of his damages claim. The state of South Australia objected to this document being introduced on the grounds that it was irrelevant, even though they had commissioned it and they had published it. It was eventually received by the judge as an admission against interest. Perhaps an additional surprise and a disappointment that the state of South Australia has announced that it will appeal the judgment which Bruce Trevorrow obtained in August of last year. And it's a curious decision because Bruce actually got a very handsome verdict. He won $800,000 plus legal costs. And the state of South Australia have paid him the money and have said they don't want it back, but they do want to appeal the judgment, which I guess means that they want to make sure that future plaintiffs will have a more difficult time recovering damages against the state. There's another point I probably should mention. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I told you that the state of South Australia had received a written opinion from the Crown Solicitor back in the early 50s saying they didn't have power to remove children from their parents. We got hold of that document, or the solicitor did, in the late 1990s. She went down to the state archives in South Australia and applied for documents relating to Bruce in particular and the Stolen Generations generally. And various files were produced, including a file of Crown Solicitor's opinions. Upon payment of the photocopying fee, that opinion and others were given to her. Years later, during the trial in 2005, the Crown said, "Oh, we claim privilege. We claim privilege in that document because it's a legal advice." And the judge said, "Well, no, because you've handed it over voluntarily." And they went to the full court appealing that decision whilst the trial proceeded. They were very anxious to make sure that that opinion was not received by the court. They failed in that again. Now, there's a few things to say all about this. First of all, it was good for Bruce that he won. That was very nice. But what is important about the case beyond Bruce's interest in it is the finding that it was foreseeable in the 1950s that removing a child from his or her parents was harmful. Not only that, not only was it harmful, but it had to be done only ever as a last resort, and even then it had to be done with great care in order to make sure that the harm inflicted was less than the harm that you're trying to avoid. There's no doubt that then, as now, there are some children who are at great risk if left with their natural parents. And removing them in order to avoid that harm is an understandable response of a caring government. But in doing so, they knew that they were inflicting harm. And the question is, what justifies the harm? Well, now, in some cases, the harm was justified by avoiding greater harm that was a result of the circumstances they were in. That simply didn't work in Bruce's case. A second reason might be the informed consent of the parents. For whatever reason, some parents do actually wish to relinquish custody of their children. But beyond those, you're left with the rather embarrassing reason, the true reason in most instances, that it would in some way be better for the child to be brought up in a white household. And the other explanation they can give, and it's even more embarrassing, is, well, the law said we could do it. Of course, in South Australia, that's not quite true, but in some jurisdictions it was. So here it is. We have a government which at last has had the decency to acknowledge the occurrence of a great and sustained moral wrong that caused great harm. And we know from the findings in Trevorrow's case and perhaps from reading otherwise, we know that that harm was foreseeable at the time. Now, if you have acknowledged that there was a great wrong and great harm suffered as a consequence, and that harm was foreseeable at the time, it seems a pretty natural next step that you will offer something to compensate the person for the harm suffered. And that's why I think it's regrettable that the Rudd government has said already that they do not intend to establish a compensation scheme. If Australia is truly to embrace a new sense of decency, then it seems to me we have to take the additional step of offering a rational and responsibly administered scheme of compensation for those who suffered as a result of being stolen as children. Now, a scheme like this has to be simple, it has to be lawyer-free, it has to be run with an eye to the benevolent intention to which it gives effect. But it seems to me that it could work roughly like this, that you allow people to identify themselves as members of the stolen generations. If a check of the records demonstrates that the person is in fact a member of the stolen generations, then they should have immediate access to all files relevant to their circumstances. And then the panel assessing compensation should classify the person into one of four categories. One, taken with proper welfare reason. Two, taken with informed parental consent. Three, taken without welfare reasons or consent, but survived it more or less intact. And four, taken without welfare reasons, without consent, and did not survive the consequences. I don't know how the numbers would work out, but I would reckon that perhaps half those that were taken would fall into the last category. And in that last category, I would suggest that something in the order of $50,000 to $75,000 compensation would be a respectable way of acknowledging the reality of that person's circumstances, and lower compensation for people in the other categories. Given that these cases, when they go to court, cost the government at least $2 million for their own expenses, and if they lose, another $2 million or so for the plaintiff in damages and expenses, it seems to me not only to be decent but also rational to approach compensation in a principled way. And it should be a scheme which includes the states and territories and the Commonwealth government all working together. Because one of the most dreadful outcomes would be that people with broadly similar circumstances either succeeded with compensation or not, depending on which side of the Murray they were on, or choose your state borders. The other reason for suggesting this, apart from an appeal to simple decency, is that litigation of the sort that Bruce went through is not for the faint-hearted. Governments fight hard when they are sued. They really fight hard. And one of the worst possible outcomes would be for members of the stolen generations to spend their remaining days locked in brutal litigation with a determined and well-resourced state as their opponent. Now, the fact is that I and many other lawyers around the country have been getting phone calls from members of the stolen generations, in part as a result of Bruce's case and in part as a result of the apology. The apology, let me assure you, makes no difference to their legal prospects, but it has brought to the surface a history of pain which some people quite properly think entitles them to be compensated. It would be a great pity if the newly disclosed decency of the Rudd government failed at the next obvious step.
This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, and we're listening to the annual Manning Clark Lecture, this year delivered by Julian Burnside QC. Having described the apparent failure of the legal system to address issues raised by the stolen generation, he now turns his attention to two other controversial areas: the Howard government's anti-terror laws and its legislation concerning migration and detention. Back to Julian Burnside at the National Library of Australia in Canberra.
Let me then turn to what was meant to be my subject, which is the the rule of law. In 1973, Friedrich Hayek, whom I don't normally quote, wrote, "The effective limitation of power is the most important problem of social order. Government is indispensable for the formulation of such an order, only to protect against coercion and violence from others. But as soon as, to achieve this, government successfully claims the monopoly of coercion and violence, it becomes the chief threat to individual freedom." Those words, it seems to me, resonate quite powerfully in the post-September 11 Western world. The rule of law is democracy's answer to the rule of men. In 1603, James I considered himself as standing above the law. He could and did deal with people as he saw fit. He could set aside the laws made by Parliament or set aside the common law as he chose. He personally authorised the torture of Guy Fawkes, even though that would have been otherwise illegal. He exacted compulsory loans from his nobles without the sanction of Parliament, which is what got Parliament quite upset, because the power to impose taxes was their ultimate source of strength. The establishment of the rule of law was the great triumph of the constitutional struggles of the 17th century in England. At the start of the 17th century, James I, as I say, thought he stood above the law, but by the time the Stuarts gave way to the Hanoverians, they had already conceded that they ruled subject to the law. They acknowledged that the law bound them as much as anyone else. The rule of law requires that all people, including the head of state, including the executive government, should be subject to the law, and that independent judges are the arbiters of what the law is. And by this means, governments are made accountable for their conduct. Unfortunately, during the last 10 years, there have been significant inroads into important aspects of the rule of law. Bear in mind for this that the rule of law has as an essential element the capacity of the courts to supervise the conduct of the executive government in order to ensure that the executive government does not exceed its lawful authority. In 2002, the ASIO legislation was, we have heard of ASIO, was amended to permit the incommunicado detention for a week at a time of people not suspected of any offence. It's enough that they are thought to have information about someone else who is suspected of involvement in a terrorist offence. The person can be taken into isolated custody. They will not have access to legal help of their own choosing. They will not be permitted to tell family or friends where they are or what is happening to them. And they must answer questions upon pain of 5 years jail. Once they are released, they are not allowed to tell anyone where they've been or what has happened to them on pain of imprisonment. And if anyone else publishes an account of what happened to them, they also face the prospect of imprisonment. And all of this happens without the intervention of a court. The most fundamental interference with the freedoms of a person not suspected of anything and without the intervention of a court. In 2005, the Parliament passed measures permitting control orders and preventative detention orders. Preventative detention orders are orders which send a person to prison for 14 days, not because they've committed an offence, not because they've been convicted of anything, but because it is thought that they might commit an offence. The order for preventative detention is made in secret on secret evidence, and the first the subject knows about it is when they are arrested and put into prison. And even then, they're not allowed to know the evidence that was used against them. Likewise, with a control order, which has various degrees of severity, but at its most extreme can be house arrest for up to 12 months without access to electronic communications, again, the order is made in secret, on secret evidence, and the first thing the person knows about it is when they receive the control order and are taken into custody. Now, the government made much of the fact that both of these orders would be susceptible to judicial review. In other words, you can go to a court and say the order was not justified, it involved an excessive jurisdiction, or it went beyond what is authorised by the relevant provisions. The difficulty is that the provisions themselves forbid the person to be told the evidence which was used against them. And it is the most fundamental principle of anything like a fair hearing that at least you have the power to know the case you have to meet. That has been done away with. In a different context, again, you have extraordinary executive power in the security context. ASIO has power under its Act to make an adverse security assessment of a person. Interestingly, the criteria to be taken into account in assessing a person on security grounds do not have to be identified. They're not identified in the legislation. There is power for the Director General of Security to promulgate a series of criteria which ASIO operatives will then apply in particular cases. But that document is classified secret. And so you can't know what are the criteria against which your security status is to be assessed. If an adverse security assessment is made, the result can be immediate cancellation of your passport if you're a citizen, or immediate cancellation of your visa if you're a non-citizen, or refusal of a visa if you're trying to come here. It can involve disqualification from some types of employment opportunity, and in any event, it can involve you in very considerable personal embarrassment and difficulty. Unfortunately, along with the power to make an adverse assessment, there is also a newly introduced power of the Attorney General to regulate the extent to which a person subject to an assessment is allowed to know what has been done to them. Let me give you a practical example. An Australian citizen's passport was cancelled as a result of an adverse security assessment. Because he's a citizen, he's entitled to go to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and complain about the making of the assessment. In the AAT, as a matter of course, the tribunal will order that all the government's relevant documents be made available to the applicant. That order was made in this man's case. When the documents came, they were mostly blanked out. They were accompanied by a certificate signed by the late lamented Philip Maxwell Ruddock, who certified, and I quote, that disclosure of the contents of the documents would be contrary to the public interest because disclosure would prejudice security. I further certify that evidence proposed to be adduced and submissions proposed to be made by or on behalf of ASIO concerning the documents are of such a nature that the disclosure of the evidence or submissions would be contrary to the public interest because it would prejudice security. As the responsible minister, I do not consent to a person representing the applicant being present when evidence described above is adduced and such submissions are made. Now, I acted as counsel for this bloke, and we went along to the AAT, spent about half an hour or an hour in the tribunal telling him what it was about and what the problem was. And then I and Lawrence Maher, my junior, were asked to leave the tribunal, and we sat outside for the next day and a half while the government gave their evidence and made their submissions. And to this day, I haven't the faintest idea what the case against us was, and my client has no idea either. It seems to me a scandalous thing that an Australian citizen should be required to try and vindicate their rights with such a hopeless handicap as that. The same sort of problem applies for non-citizens if they are faced with assessments of the same sort. And interestingly, one of the answers that you get when you challenge these things is, can we have a look at the criteria by reference to which we are assessed? And the answer is, no, you can't, because that's a secret document. So you don't know the test and you don't know the evidence. How can anyone possibly hope to win in such a challenge? It gives, in substance, an unfettered discretion to one part of the executive, ASIO, to do what it will with people, and to another part of the executive, the Attorney General, to make sure that no one finds out what was done to them. For very many years, I was involved in Musica Viva, a marvellous chamber music organisation which I'm sure all of you support, and if you don't already, you will hereafter. One of my friends who I met through Musica Viva was a bloke called Paul Morowitz, who was a very colourful guy who'd come originally, I think, from Hungary. And Paul had been on the Victorian Committee of Musica Viva back in the late 1950s, when the organisation was relatively new. Paul died a few years ago, and his executor sent me a document by post which he thought I'd find interesting. And what it is an ASIO minute. With a date sometime in the late 1950s, it lists all the members of the Victorian Committee of the Musica Viva Society, including a couple of ministers of religion and various worthies, and Paul Morowitz's name is there and underlined. And at the foot of the document, in handwriting, is the note, "This is the organisation that brings Greek and Yugoslav musicians to Australia." Now, maybe they've improved since then. I know they cost a lot more now, but I still prefer the rule of law to the rule of men. And given that human beings are fallible, it seems to me desirable that their failings should be capable of being exposed in court in order to vindicate the rights of individuals. Unfettered ministerial power is a very important element in the erosion of the rule of law. There are many aspects of the of ministerial discretion, especially in the security context and in immigration. The new Minister for Immigration, to his credit, has said that he is uncomfortable with the extent of the discretions which he has been given. Let me give you a couple of examples. Most of you will be aware, I think, that the previous government took a case called Al-Khateb to the High Court of Australia. The mandatory detention provisions of the Migration Act, which were introduced under the Keating government, say that a non-citizen without a visa must be detained and must remain in detention until they get a visa or until they're removed from the country. That, in essence, is the mandatory detention provisions. They haven't committed an offence, they just have to be detained for the duration. Mr. Al-Khateb came to Australia. He applied for a visa, protection visa. He was refused, couldn't bear it in detention, asked to be removed rather than languishing in Woomera. But after many months, he was still in Woomera because he's stateless, and so there was nowhere they could remove him to. Now, there was an impasse. There are only two ways out of detention, a visa which has been refused and removal which is not possible. So what do you do? Obvious answer is you introduce a new visa category. In fact, the Howard government argued all the way to the High Court that that man, innocent of any offence, not suspected of being a risk to the community, can remain in detention for the rest of his life. By a majority of 4-3, on the 6th of August 2004, the High Court accepted that argument as being the true meaning of the words in the Migration Act and constitutionally valid with that meaning. You may recall that after the 2004 election, Petro Georgiou and a couple of other Liberal backbenchers, troubled about some of the worst excesses of the mandatory detention system, managed to push through some reforms. And one of the reforms they pushed through was new discretions for the minister. And one of the discretions he was given was a discretion to relieve people like Mr. Al-Khateb or anyone else who'd been in detention for more than a few years by granting them a visa temporarily until some way of turfing him out could be found. Now, it was a curious mixed feeling that we had when these discretions were introduced, because whilst you can be grateful on behalf of people like Mr. Al-Khateeb, who was released from detention as a result. Nevertheless, there is something uncomfortable about the idea that the minister can play God, that the minister can say, well, here's a person, will you remain in for life or will I let you out? Let's see, how do I feel? You know, that is not the way democracies are meant to work. It would be worse if his discretion was one which enabled him to place people in detention indefinitely as a matter of discretion. It's not that. But the fact is that these unfettered, unreviewable discretions erode the principle of the rule of law, because the fact is that people in detention like Al-Khateeb don't know, if they look at the laws, what is going to happen to them, except that they'll be there forever. But the other power that he has, a very interesting one, which we need to think about a bit in the next few months, I think, is the power under Section 501, which is to cancel a person's visa on the character ground. You'll remember Dr. Hanif got the rough end of that one. But this was a provision introduced by the Howard government in 1999. Up until then, whilst the minister could cancel a person's visa because they had committed a serious offence while in Australia, it was restricted to people who'd been in Australia for less than 10 years. Section 501 does not contain such a limit. And so we have extraordinarily hard consequences at the discretion of the minister. Let me give a couple of examples. Stefan Nystrom, whose case ultimately went to the High Court. His parents had lived in Australia since 1966. In 1974, his parents were on holiday in Sweden. The mother was pregnant, and due to a complication with the pregnancy, it was impossible for her to fly home. So Stefan was born in Sweden. He was brought back to Australia 27 days after he was born. By the time he was 33, he'd gotten into trouble with the law. He'd never bothered taking out citizenship. He did his time in jail, and then the minister cancelled his visa and deported him to Sweden, a place where he has never been, where he does not speak the language and has no contacts whatever. He has spent his entire life, all but 27 days, in Australia, and we threw him out because he had done his time in prison. Second one, which you'll be familiar with, Robert Jovicic, was born in France. His parents were Serbian. He was brought to Australia aged 2. He got into trouble with the law, and by the time he was 38, he finished a term of imprisonment and the minister cancelled his visa. He was then deported to Serbia, where it was thought that he was a citizen, but he wasn't. He lived rough on the streets of Belgrade and eventually embarrassed the Australian government by sleeping on the steps of the Australian embassy in Belgrade. Public opinion shifted, and so Jovicic was brought back to Australia somewhat with ill grace via the previous government, and they gave him initially a brief temporary visa and then a 2-year temporary visa due to expire next January. The current minister has just given him permanent residency. It strikes me as being a fascinating thing that the last government, indecent enough to throw out a man to the streets of Serbia in circumstances where he couldn't conceivably fend for himself, embarrassed as they were, had to bring him back, but even then only brought him back temporarily and urged him to take out Serbian citizenship so that he could go back there. I say publicly it is to the credit of Chris Evans that he granted Robert Jovicic a permanent residency visa. And Stephen Ongell came to Australia aged 18 months in 1970. He was deported to Turkey in 2003, leaving behind his wife and 2 daughters. Now, lots of Australian citizens have got criminal records. Lots of them have got criminal records worse than any of those people or others we could refer to. The theory is that if you commit a crime and you serve your sentence, you've paid your debt to society. But if you have the misfortune to be Australian in every respect, but not having that crucial piece of paper, then under Section 501, you can be expelled from the country and thrown into a country about which you know nothing whatever. There is obvious and abundant evidence that expulsion in circumstances that, like this, cause terrible hardship. All of Nystrom's family are in Australia. All of Jovicic's family are in Australia. All of Onjil's family are in Australia. There's a man at the moment in immigration detention in Melbourne who has spent the last 26 years in Australia. He got in trouble with the law. He served 4 years in prison. On the day he was released from prison, the minister, Kevin Andrews, cancelled his visa. Actually, it must have been... Yeah, no, I think it was Kevin Andrews, cancelled his visa. He was taken directly into immigration detention. He has spent the last 7 years in immigration detention and attempting to fight his deportation. So for a crime for which he was to do 4 years, he has now spent 11 years in custody and in immigration detention, of course, as you all know, he is liable by the day for the cost of his own detention. It's another of the little interesting depredation, but let's not blame that. Let's not blame that on the last government because that measure was introduced by the Keating government. It remains to be seen, of course, whether the present government will carry forward its newfound decency, the decency which I think many Australians applauded, in getting rid of some of these appalling statutes from the books. It seems to me that if we are serious about the rule of law and the rights of people in Australia, if we are serious about the importance of justice as one of the things for which the human spirit most yearns, then it is essential that we do something to improve the availability of legal aid and the funding of community legal centres. Because justice is one of the great promises of democracy. And when justice and law part company, as they do in some of the legislation I've discussed, we are betrayed. When Parliament makes unjust laws, we are betrayed. When justice is placed beyond reach, then democracy fails. There is work to be done in Australia because Australia is not just yet. Thank you.
Controversial barrister and human rights advocate Julian Burnside QC, delivering this year's Manning Clark Lecture. His topic, The Rule of Law and Citizens' Rights in Australia, delivered at the National Library of Australia in Canberra. We'll put a link to the transcript on the Big Ideas website, so keep an eye out. And Julian Burnside's new book is titled Watching Brief. It's a passionate, professional and personal reflection on human rights, law and justice. I'm Damien Carrick from The Law Report, heard here on ABC Radio National every Tuesday at 8:30 a.m. and 8 p.m, where you'll hear people like Julian Burnside on many and varied aspects of the law and how it relates to our lives. Catch you then. Next week on Big Ideas, the Massey Lectures and the start of a marvellous five-part talk by writer Alberto Mangel. His series, The City of Words, is an enchanting rumination on the power of stories to heal a broken world. You won't want to miss it, here on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.